This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Central Illinois Republican Congressman Darren LaHood says assertions the new GOP health care proposal will only give tax breaks to the wealthy are not true.
Talk to any small or medium-sized business in McLean County. They are going to get a break, but those aren't wealthy people. Those are people in the middle class that employ people every day.
LaHood talks with GLT's Willis Kern about the GOP plan and how he'd like to see it shaped, and he hints of a possible town hall meeting next month. A new bike sharing system launches in the community today. You'll hear about Bike Share 309 from Town of Normal planner Mercy Davison and a representative of Zagster, the company behind the bike share program. And a viral video last week showed a 10-year-old Bloomington boy in police handcuffs. During an exclusive interview, you'll hear from the boy's mother. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's March 20th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Calling it a good first step, Central Illinois Congressman Darren LaHood likes many aspects of the GOP proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act. But the Dunlap Republican says it needs some more work. GLT's Willis Kern has this interview.
Democrats don't like the new GOP American Health Care Act. AARP has come out against the bill. The American Medical Association is concerned millions of Americans will lose coverage and benefits, and even some conservative Republicans don't like the bill. Congressman Darren LaHood serves the 18th District in Illinois. Congressman, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Willis, great to be with you and your listeners today.
Let's start with the House plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. Are you supporting the American Health Care Act as it's written?
Well, I think it's a first step in the process, Willis, of healthcare. I mean, this is a complicated, nuanced issue. I was not in Congress when the Affordable Care Act was passed or when Obamacare was passed some 6-7 years ago. But I do know this. If we do nothing in Congress, Obamacare will fail. Now, that's just not my opinion. That's the opinion of Democrats and Republicans and independents. So, knowing that it will fail if we do nothing, we have to fix Obamacare. And so I think this is a good first step, but there is a long ways to go in terms of fixing Obamacare. There are some things that I think are good to keep in there, but there are other things that I think we need to change. And so that's what I'll be looking for as this open, transparent process continues in the House of Representatives.
What are the important things to keep in there?
Yeah, well, I would make a couple observations, Willis. One is being able to keep your children on their parents' insurance till 25 or 26 is a good thing. I think that has to stay in there, and that's in this plan that was introduced last week. I think not being allowed to discriminate against pre-existing conditions is in this bill, and I think that is a good thing also. So those are a couple things that I think need to remain in whatever plan we put forward.
And what are the things about this particular proposal that you don't particularly like?
Well, I think there's a number of things that I think we have to look at. First of all, we have to bring competition into the marketplace. In my district, Willis, I represent 710,000 people in central and west central Illinois, many of those in Bloomington Normal. The number one complaint I get in my office over the last 2 years has been healthcare has gone up exponentially. So in my district, 55% premium increases have gone up over the last 3 years. Deductibles are way too high. And if you remember the promises that were made with Obamacare, you're going to be able to keep your doctor. That hasn't happened. You're going to have lower cost of healthcare. That hasn't happened. You're going to have a lot more healthcare options. That hasn't happened. So we have to fix the high cost of healthcare. And I think you do that by bringing in the private sector, more competition, and figuring out from a public policy standpoint how you do that the right way. I think one of the things that we're going to look at, not in this bill, but in the next phase of healthcare reform, being able to go across state lines for insurance. You should have options when it comes to healthcare. In my district, I have 19 counties. In many of the counties, Willis, you only have one healthcare option, one insurance company to go to. That is not the original intent of Obamacare. being able to go across state lines so you can look at a plan from Florida or Texas or Missouri or Iowa or Illinois. Those options, that kind of competition will help drive down costs. And that's really what we have to do. Small and medium-sized businesses, they complain every single day with the high cost of health care. So that has to change as part of this plan. The other thing that I would mention, when we look at Medicaid, Medicaid was originally intended as a program that, you know, helped fund health care for poor women and children. And we should do that. That's what the program set up for, is to help those individuals. Since Bill Clinton was president, Willis, Medicaid has tripled in this country. So now you have able-bodied working men that can qualify for Medicaid in some instances. I think we have to get back to the original intent of Medicaid, and that's a controversial issue, but we are on the hook as taxpayers for Medicaid, and I think there's a better way to look at how we can reform that program, make it more effective, efficient, and accountable. And with everything in government, we should be looking at, again, how you can make it a better system and revise it, and that's what I'll be looking at.
Well, cost savings is one thing, but the Congressional Budget Office estimates that 14 million people are going to lose their health care if this bill goes into effect, and by 2026, 24 million won't be insured. So no matter how much it costs, if people are losing their health care, how is that any better?
Well, if you look at our, this plan that was put forth, it doesn't have the mandate in there for young people. One complaint that we heard is young people that are out of college and healthy are mandated, or they're fined under the current Obamacare system for not getting health insurance. Under our plan, you have that option to do that. So you're not required to do that. So the numbers with CBO that you just referenced, a lot of those are taking into account young people that may not choose to or may not want to participate in healthcare except for catastrophic or if they have high-risk conditions or pre-existing conditions, I should say. So that's part of the numbers. But there is no doubt, I will tell you this, Willis, we have to make sure that we don't pull the rug out from anybody that has pre-existing conditions, that has a health care plan now that they rely on. But I think a lot of those numbers relate to younger people being involved. But I look at this as the start of the process. This will be open. It will be transparent. I don't anticipate that we'll have a vote on this for 2 or 3 weeks, maybe longer on that. We're going through the committee process. I think this bill will be amended, changed, and revised. And the last thing I will say, I don't look at this as a partisan issue. If you remember during the presidential race, you know, Hillary Clinton talked about fixing, revising, amending Obamacare. Both sides agree that we need to fix the current system to bring down costs.
You talk about enrollment. Let's talk a little bit about how that affects the risk pool. Isn't that going to affect the risk pool, more healthy Americans foregoing insurance, worsening the risk pool and causing the premiums to go up?
Well, one part of this proposed bill put forth is giving more discretion to the states and relieving the burden on the federal government. Many of the states across the country have been very creative, and they've been very successful in setting up high-risk pooling when it comes to pre-existing conditions or people that have health care that costs a lot of money. And so I think as you push more of these things to the states, I think that will give them an opportunity, depending on what state you're in, to be a part of a program that is a better funded program, more fiscally sound. And frankly, that's what a lot of the governors have asked for, is more discretion when it comes to health care. Now, the problem with that is, Willis, sometimes you'll have a state that maybe isn't the best run state, and Illinois probably falls into that category because we haven't had a budget in 2 years. But there is definitely an emphasis on pushing that to the states to give them more flexibility and more discretion in implementing, you know, many of these programs.
Let's take a look at what some other Republicans are saying. Congressman Rob Whitman of Virginia said, "It is clear that this bill is not consistent with the repeal and replace principles for which I stand. I do not think this bill will do what it is necessary for the short and long-term best interests of the people in Virginia." And Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has asked House members not to walk the plank for a bill and put the House majority at risk for a bill that doesn't have a chance. So I assume that you disagree with these people, since you term this bill a good first step.
Well, I would mention a couple things. I think Tom Cotton doesn't think it's conservative enough. He thinks you ought to gut Medicaid and not have any tax credits. So I mean, I would agree with you, Willis. There are people on the far right, which I would put Tom Cotton in. The reason why he doesn't like the bill is it doesn't go, it's not conservative enough. And I think Whitman would be on the other side of that. But clearly you're going to have disagreement. This is a complicated, nuanced issue, and you're going to have different opinions on both sides. But in public, in this situation, as I go back to my earlier point, if we do nothing, Obamacare collapses. The trajectory that we are on, it's not fiscally sustainable, so we have to fix it. My point is, Willis, we have to look at what's worked in Obamacare, a couple of those things I mentioned, and how do we fix that? And remember, Obamacare took 3 years to implement, from the time it was introduced till the time it was fully implemented. It took 3 years. This is going to take a little time to do, but I think if we go in with the goals of keeping the things that work, but also changing, reforming, making it more effective and efficient, I think we have the ability to do that and do that in a bipartisan way.
Congressman Darren LaHood is on the phone from Washington. I'm Willis Kernan. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. You talk about a timetable. The bill has already passed two committees, this bill that was proposed in the past few days in the House. It is scheduled for a floor vote. There were 15 months of deliberations before Obamacare came up for a vote. So what is the hurry here? Does a bill such as far-reaching as this deserve some more scrutiny?
Well, I think we are going through the process of scrutiny. This was obviously a huge issue, not only in the presidential race, but in the election last year. But I also think, Willis, I mean, this was one of the issues that Republicans ran on, that President Trump ran on as candidate Trump at the time. And one thing, I think people want us to fulfill the campaign promises. But remember, this got introduced last Monday, a week ago yesterday. It went through the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Ways and Means Committee. This week it's going to go through the Budget Committee. Next week it's going to go through the Rules Committee. Again, open, transparent process. And that's just the House side. Hadn't got to the Senate yet. The other thing to remember, Willis, is, again, I wasn't in Congress at the time, but when Obamacare passed on Christmas Eve, Nancy Pelosi had the famous line, let's pass it and then we'll read it later. That is not the process we're going through. I think the process thus far has been transparent. It's been open. I think when it gets to the House floor, there will be a number of amendments that will be able to be offered to, again, fix, revise, change that. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out and how we can improve the bill.
Well, the only proposal we have right now is the one that's before us, so that's the only one we can really discuss. And it rolls back taxes for the wealthiest Americans who help pay for the ACA and rolls back the benefits to the middle and working class Americans to buy insurance. Is this helpful and is it fair?
Well, I would mention a couple things. If you think about it, in our population in the United States, about 150, 160 million people get their health insurance through their companies that they are employed by or their businesses. For the vast majority, a switch to this plan is not going to affect them. It is going to affect other people in our society. But again, when I talk about premiums going up and deductibles going way up, what this plan will do will relieve some of that burden to drive down premiums. Again, if you talk to businesses, you talk to people at the Chamber of Commerce, small and medium-sized businesses, they want relief. I think there's a combination of things that we can do to drive down those costs. I don't look at this as a tax cut for wealthy people. Talk to any small or medium-sized business in McLean County. They are going to get a break, but those aren't wealthy people. Those are people in the middle class that employ people every day, and this is going to give them some relief. And I think it is a fine line, Willis, between finding that sweet spot of, you know, reform and efficiencies that are good and keeping in place what's worked.
And you mentioned Medicaid a little bit ago. Let's take a look at one provision of this particular proposal, which block grants Medicaid back to the states. Why won't this result in unequal care from state to state? And do you have any confidence that states like Illinois, you already mentioned 2 years without a budget, are equipped to administer Medicaid?
Well, again, Medicaid has exploded exponentially across the country. It has in Illinois, and it's tripled since Bill Clinton was president. I think Medicaid, for what it was originally intended to, we should fulfill that. We should fund that. We have an obligation to do that for the working poor, for children of the poor. That has to be there. I support that 100%. I think where you run into a problem, Willis, is when you have able-bodied working men that qualify for Medicaid. I think you've got to figure out a way to transition them to, you know, to work rather than relying on Medicaid. And it's also worth noting, Willis, that only half of the states accepted the Medicaid exchange when that was put forth. For instance, Wisconsin didn't accept it, Tennessee didn't, Texas didn't, about half the states in Illinois did under Governor Pat Quinn at the time, set up these exchanges. So there's a differing view across the country, but there is no doubt when you look at changing the parameters of Medicaid, and by the way, this bill says anybody that's currently enrolled in Medicaid, it gets to stay in Medicaid, gets that funding. This changes as of 2019. I think that's a fair way to look at that moving forward.
And let's talk a little bit more about campaign promises. President Trump campaigned that everyone would be covered. So how does this bill fulfill that promise? And what role do you expect President Trump in helping to shape this bill so that it accomplishes that?
Well, everybody will cover it in the sense that, I'll go back to what I said before, the mandate currently that young people have to sign up or they get fined, right? That mandate. Everyone will have the availability of health care to sign up. But if you're a young person and you don't want to, for whatever reason, your choice, your freedom to decide, whatever that is, and that goes for other people, you have that option to not get health insurance. But you're not going to be denied because of pre-existing conditions. You're not going to be denied because you're not denied from your parents' insurance. If you're, you know, 24, 25, 26, you're going to be able to have insurance through them. So that keeps that safety net in place. But so you will have the availability of health insurance. But if people don't want to do that, they're not going to be forced to do it like we do currently under the plan.
And President Trump said that there would be a bloodbath in 2018 if Congress didn't repeal and replace Obamacare. Is there any concern that there will be an upheaval in the Senate and the House if as many as 24 million people lose their coverage, as the CBO says about this bill?
Well, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals. We have a job to do, what we were elected to do. The president has a job to do. I mean, governing is hard, right? And now we have an obligation to the people we represent to work in a bipartisan way to fix this law. Again, I've stressed this in every interview I've given. Obamacare is going to collapse. It's going to fail. And in some ways, the easy thing would do is to sit back and say, we told you so, and have it collapse. But we can't do that. And so I think I know we have an obligation to fix this. And what happens in 2018, we can't look at the next election. We have to look at how we fix this plan. That's what's in front of us right now. We just got elected in November and got sworn in January.
We received more than 70 questions on our Facebook page, and I'm going to get to some of those, run those past you. Rebecca Fortner says she received an answer to survey from you regarding the ACA, and she assumes many others did as well. How much, if at all, will constituent opinion factor into your decision regarding the replacement bill, and what were the highlights of those survey results, and should she have bothered to answer it?
Absolutely. Getting feedback from my 710,000 constituents is vital to this process. I look at every one of the surveys that comes back into my office. I read the letters, the emails, the comments on Facebook. Absolutely. Now, that doesn't mean I'm always going to agree with people, Willis. I got a very diverse district of 710,000 people. But what I promise to do is engage in dialogue, listen to everybody in my district. This is part of our democratic system, and make decisions based on what's in the best interest of our constituency. And as I said before, engaging my constituency, people, you know, there's views on all sides, right? People complain all the time about the high cost of healthcare. Why are my deductibles going up to $4,000, $5,000, $6,000? You know, why do I have premiums going up 55% in my district? So it goes back and forth on that, but I encourage people all the time to engage with our office and with me, and I try to do that every time that I come back every single weekend. My last break, I did over 25 public events throughout my district, talked about healthcare and a lot of those. Again, this is a controversial issue, but engagement, dialogue is important to this process.
Well, you have these campaign events for sure, and the overriding topic among the questions that we received on our Facebook page had to deal with the idea and the concept of face-to-face town halls. And many people wanted to know, when was your last face-to-face town hall meeting in the district? And separate from the campaign events, why are town hall meetings any different than those campaign events?
Well, I will tell you this. I've had four elections in 16 months, In the last 6 months, I've done 250 public events throughout my district and talked about health care. I did a bunch of debates last year in this process. So, anybody that wants to come meet with me at my office, I'm happy to do that. I will just tell you, Willis, my last break in Peoria, I had about 15 protesters outside of my office. I invited every single one of them into my office that day. We sat around a table and talked about this. The next time we're back on break in April, I'm considering a number of events being town hall meetings. If we can structure those in a very a civil manner, I'm not going to engage with people that are going to yell and scream and play the gotcha game. But people that want to have a dialogue and discussion, I will do that every single day that I'm back in my district. Even if you don't agree with me, that's part of our system and our democracy, and I will continue to do that.
So is it safe to say then that there will be some sort of town hall meeting with members of your constituency in the 18th district in the month of April?
As long as it is set up the right way and we have people that are willing to engage in constructive dialogue and to have a meeting that is not does not digress into disobedience and playing that gotcha game, I'm happy to do that, and we're entertaining that right now.
All right, Congressman, we had an unprecedented response on our Facebook page when we posted that we'd be talking to you today and asked for some questions. We only scratched the surface. Can you pledge to us that you'll stay engaged with GLT? We'd like to talk to you again very soon, hopefully.
Willis, I enjoyed the interview. I thought your questions were very balanced, and I look forward to coming back on with you again and continuing to stay engaged.
All right, Congressman, thanks for your time today. U.S. Representative Darren LaHood represents the 18th Congressional District of the state of Illinois. I'm Willis Kern.
Last week, the government said more than 12 million people have signed up for coverage this year under former President Barack Obama's health care law, even as the Republican-led Congress debates its repeal. Tomorrow, during Sound Ideas, you'll hear from 13th District Congressman Rodney Davis about how he feels about the Republican proposal. Listen for Charlie Schlenker's interview tomorrow during Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The town of Normal is launching a community-wide bike share system today. Users can rent a bike at one of the 9 kiosks or stations and return them to a different station or back to the same station. Stations are mostly in Normal, with one in downtown Bloomington and another at Illinois Wesleyan University. You can rent the bike by the hour or purchase an annual membership. In the studio to talk more about Zagster's Bike Share 309 is town of Normal planner, and I'm going to give you a new title, Mercy. Bicycle coordinator for the town? Does that work?
Oh, you're sneaky.
Does that? I don't think it comes with a raise.
No.
Also in the studio is Zagster Customer Success Manager Carl Alexander. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Sound Ideas today. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Carl, tell me about Zagster and its model serving small and mid-sized communities.
Yeah, it's really simple. We, as a company, have a corporate mission to make bike share the most loved form of transportation. This is something that we like to achieve in all the communities that we work in. And the way that we do it is by providing and operating bike share programs at a very affordable rate to access at any point in time on demand.
How is it different than systems like Divvy in Chicago or City Bike in New York or the DC Bike Share in Washington?
All of the locking technology is directly on the bike itself. Besides that, it's very similar in the opportunity to operate and maintain it, but you simply register by downloading the app and accessing and interacting with it with your app. There's also an option to rent via text message if you don't have a smartphone.
And Mercy, how is Zagster a good fit for the town of Normal? Why this particular bike share company?
Well, we did a lot of looking around within the last couple of years to figure out how we could bring a bike share program to our community. And frankly, the big ones that you see in large cities are well beyond what we could afford, partly because the technology is so high-end and built into all the stations, the docking and all that. And what Zagster has come up with is a system that is just very affordable for us. And they're providing a turnkey operation. So instead of owning the system, we're basically paying them to provide a service. They answer all the service calls. They balance the system. They move bikes around. They maintain the bikes. They answer all the phone calls. So it's a service they're providing.
And why is the town of Normal a good location for Zagster's bike share, Carl?
Bike sharing isn't just for the big cities. In each and every city around the country, we want to strive to make biking a transit option that people consider each and every time they leave their house. That could be for transit purposes, A to B, especially within the half-mile to two-mile radius, wherever you may be traveling to. It's a really great option. You don't have to worry about parking no matter where you go. It's also great for preventative health and wellness. It's a great option for recreation, especially with the Constitution Trail that you have here in town. And also, it's really fun for visitors coming into town, too. You don't have to worry about driving again. And you have a lot more flexibility, and you can simply just go right up to whatever destination you want to go.
Carl mentioned health and wellness. What is the mission for this system as it concerns the town? Is it to reduce traffic and congestion? Is it to improve air quality or improve public health?
You know, it's interesting, Mike. I think this program is going to hit so many important goals of the town, but I don't think we have the kind of traffic problems that we could fairly say, you know, this program is going to solve traffic problems. Nor do I think we have such air quality issues that's the primary goal of this, although we will benefit in both of those ways. I think we're very excited about presenting people with more transportation options. We know that people are choosing to get themselves around in different ways, not just younger people, also baby boomers, empty nesters. People are just really interested in trying things out, and getting it onto a bike is one of those things. And this will be the first opportunity a lot of people have had to get on a bike in years. You think about all the people you know who just haven't owned a bike since they were in like junior high school, and they're not going to go buy one on a whim, but maybe they ride a bike share bike, and it's a great way for them to get on a bike without investing in one.
So who are the customers for Bike Share 309, Mercy?
I think that some of the primary audiences at first will be students at the university, people visiting the university, whether that's family members of students or people that are visiting to see if their kids want to go here. I think people coming to the uptown hotels are going to be major users of this. There's a station right by the hotels, right by the trail. How many times have you traveled and been in a hotel and wished you could have gotten a bike to ride on a beautiful trail? So I think those will be our first audiences that are really obviously successful. And then we think people in town too. Again, people who just would love to ride a bike on the trail but just don't own one.
How does Zagster programs like Bike Share 309 serve lower income populations or minority populations? Carl?
We strive to achieve a very flexible model in our bike sharing program and operations. That is in regards to the hardware. We have the opportunity to install stations at a very low rate because all the technology is directly on the bicycle itself. If we want a station at a particular location, in all chances, we can make it happen. In regards to pricing models, we strive to provide at a very affordable rate. Again, really like to stress that flexible model to make sure folks, regardless of income and also accessibility, have the opportunity to ride.
And Mercy, what did the town do in terms of looking at low-income or minority populations? Is it concerned citing the actual bike share stations?
Sure. It's a great question and something we've talked about since the very first meeting. The reality is we could only start so big with so many stations. And so the 9 stations we have are they're fairly linear in that they parallel the trail and Main Street. And it's really kind of in the core of the community where we assume it will be the most successful the most quickly. And the hope is once we see how it works, get people on board, people understand it, then we can look at, you know, the economics of expanding the program. It's definitely something we're thinking about, but we really needed to start with what we thought would be the most successful.
And you said, Carl, that a smartphone isn't necessary. People can access the system via text.
Correct.
But they do need a credit card.
Correct.
Of some sort.
Yeah, you do need a payment card in order to ride. That's for the low fares to ride and also for accountability. Can't just ride away with a bike.
Sure. So let's talk about the scope or the area that is covered. 9 stations. Is that big enough to be successful?
We talked a lot with Zagster about that, and Carl can definitely weigh in. It was a balancing act between how much could we afford right out of the ground, but also you don't want to invest in something that just won't be successful by being too small. So we've really tried to be smart about where we place these stations, and we felt pretty comfortable with it, and I think Zagster did too.
Do you have ridership goals? Do you have a number of Mercy or Carl, either one of you, in terms of the number of riders you think will be accessing this system in the first year, say?
The core goal is to make sure that we have strong annual members to adopt. I wouldn't be surprised in the first year we saw a few or somewhere in the hundreds of annual members join the program. And then also in terms of trips, we'll find ourselves in the thousands this year. So in regards to a certain threshold to hit, we're going to be looking at that in the next few weeks once the system gets up and running and we're seeing rates of usage.
In other communities where maybe they haven't hit ridership goals, what is that assigned to do? Is it assigned to sort of reevaluate and think, well, maybe we need to move the kiosks or we need to pull back? Or do you double down and actually put more kiosks out? What's the approach for that?
Yeah, it's a bit of a rock and hard place, isn't it? When a program isn't achieving its intended riding goals, there's definitely a root cause that we tend to find. That could be a pricing plan that we need to adjust. It could be more station locations. And it's up to our job here at Zagster to consult and provide our services to make it happen.
And you talked about the pricing models here. Let's talk about some of that. It's $3 an hour, or can you get into the membership pricing, Carl?
Sure. So all you need to do is download the Zagster app or visit zagster.com/bikeshare309 to join. Annual membership is just $40. And also to kick off the program, if you put in promo code BIKE309ANNUAL, that's capital B, capital A, you get $5 off the annual membership. And so once you purchase the annual membership, it includes unlimited trips under 1 hour free. So you can take as many 1 hour trips and $40 over the course of the year as you want.
So how does it work? How does the system know if you're out longer than an hour?
So that's an interaction with the app or via text message. It calculates the amount of time you're riding. And then when you finish your ride, bring it back to a Zagster station, it tabulates your fare.
And you check it in via your app?
That's correct.
So if I'm 59 minutes into my ride, but I'm 10 minutes away from a Zagster station, I could pull over and just say I'm done and then keep riding?
No, so we do have GPS enforcement.
Oh, okay, all right. So there is some protection for those people that might want to, you know, keep rolling.
Nice.
Even though, yeah. So tell me about the bikes. What kind of bikes are they?
So we use a Fuji Breezer model of bikes. It has a step-through design that allows for really simple riding. 8 speeds, very light. I don't know if you've ridden in other bike share programs, but very easy.
Yeah,
to
other
ride.
Bikes are they're tanks.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
They're built to take some abuse. Are these robust bikes?
They are robust bicycles. They are, you know, very durable, have very strong wheels, kind of similar to a mountain bike design. It has a front basket so that you can place anything if you go to the grocery store or purchase anything along the way. And also it has front and rear lights just in case you're riding at night.
What kind of issues occur that can interfere with a positive customer experience? What happens that, you know, upsets a customer as they're using this system?
Hmm. So there could be, you know, various, if anything happens, if the tire's a little bit flat, there are pumps at each station, but we do want to make sure that it's a smooth riding experience. If there's anything that goes wrong, whether billing issues, anything like that, we do have a 24/7 rider support team that you can reach out to via the app, email, or phone.
So, Mercy, where is Bloomington in this effort? It seems like Normal has sort of gifted this to the ISU and the Bloomington communities. Are you expecting more participation from ISU and Bloomington at some point?
Primarily we were very interested in getting this program up and running. We are already a bicycle-friendly community through the League of American Bicyclists program. We're very proud of that, and we're constantly working to maintain that. Many people ask about opportunities to rent bikes or share bikes, so we think there's a demand out there. We did approach Advocate Broman, and they have agreed to financially participate in the program. So they're the only financial partner we have. We do want the system to be successful, though, so we knew that we needed a couple stations that wouldn't necessarily be in Normal. And so the two places we're putting them are institutions that we partner with anyway, Illinois Wesleyan and also the Route 66 Visitors Museum or Visitor Center, which we all have an interest in that being as successful as possible. So we're really excited about those two locations. You know, we really didn't, to be fair, like we didn't talk to the city of Bloomington about coming on board as a financial sponsor because we just wanted to keep moving. And it's more difficult when you try to partner up. So we'll see, though, if it's really popular and people want it in Bloomington, they may start talking about doing it, too.
I mean, I could think of 3 or 4 West Side locations right now that might be good Zagster stations to to eventually put those kiosks in.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, when we thought about naming the system, we intentionally didn't pick a name that was normal. Because we do want the community to see it as a community amenity. Clearly, if you're on a bicycle, you don't care if you're on the east or west or the north or south side of our dividing lines. It's you're just on a bike and you want it to work.
So Illinois State University already has a bike share program that's available to use for faculty and staff with an existing ISU ID. It's essentially free. How does this program work in tandem with or in competition against other existing bike shares, Carl?
It's a different model. For a bike share or a bike rental program on campus, you can generally use it for longer extended periods of time, and you have the opportunity to bring it home. But then again, the availability is more limited. So that's the big differentiator, and it's the old adage that bikes breed more bikes. So hopefully their program will see a lot greater success with the introduction of the bike share program.
And we talked about some mission goals. Are there ridership goals? Did we talk about numbers?
We did. Carl just said hundreds of members and thousands of rides. I'm going with that. I think that's great. Okay. I don't know if we mean like 500. Do we mean 300? I'm somewhere in there.
All right. So whatever number you reach the first year, you'll be hoping for an increase year to year.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Is there a benchmark for a community this size, Carl, with the number of stations that are needed to make a system like this successful? Is 9 enough?
Mm-hmm. Great question. We really want to make sure that there are enough stations to make sure it's easy enough to just go outside and rent a bike wherever you may be. If that goal is to make sure that it's a recreation option, having it accessible in each and every recreation location is very important. But if we want to make it a viable transit option from A to B anywhere in town, then you want to have a station every couple blocks. So it really aligns with the goals of the system and the goals of the community.
And Mercy, do you have a particular priority, or does the town have a particular priority in terms of customers? Are you looking for people to use this for transportation or recreation?
I think given where we have placed the stations, the more likely use is going to be recreation, because I see those hotel users and people visiting ISU's campus. I mean, this is thousands of people we're talking about. I see them using it, and it becomes an economic development tool for us. And so I see the use of somebody saying, like, I'm going to try to get to work using Zagster Bike Share 309. It's going to be less because of where the stations are. I mean, you'd have to live near one of them, and then your job would have to be near one of them. So, you know, it's really an economic development tool and recreation, I think, to start with.
And the whole thing rolls out tonight. There's a ribbon cutting. What time and where?
It does. 6:30 at the Gateway Plaza, which is right next to Uptown Station and the Children's Museum. Be a ribbon cutting, some bikes out for people to look at. And we actually rolled in the St. Paddy's Day Parade this past Saturday, and it was a great ride.
On the Fuji Breezers.
On the award-winning Fuji Breezers, yeah.
All right. That's Mercy Davison. She's the planner for the Town of Normal. Carl Alexander is a customer success manager at Zagster. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. It's Sound Ideas on GLT. A photograph of a Bloomington police officer handcuffing a 10-year-old boy went viral on social media recently. Police were responding to a complaint that the boy was throwing rocks in the parking lot of a downtown church. The boy has been charged with disorderly conduct, but because he was on probation for a previous charge of destruction of government property for spray painting his name in a city park, he now faces suspension of his probation on the previous charge, a felony. When the boy's 16-year-old brother tried to intervene in the most recent incident, he was charged with resisting arrest. The boy's mother, Antonetta Simmons, says her sons are no angels, and she too was arrested previously on a drug charge, which she denies. Simmons told GLT's Judy Valente that once a family has a brush with the law or complains about Bloomington police, they become targets for frequent police stops. It's a complaint community activists say they hear often from the city's African-American residents.
Last year, I worked with the folks over at the Tool Library, Mid-Central Community Action, different community officials to try to bring awareness that we are being harassed. And it's not just my household, it's everybody. It's the Black folks in our area are being targeted.
But what do you see?
It's not just me. I see it with a lot of folks, particularly the younger folks that hang out with me or my kids. You could see kids walking up the street and the police will stop them. Particularly one kid had just gotten out of jail and he was walking up the street about to come to the house. Police swooped in on him and he was arrested again. He had to go sit 30 days. And it's like these kids don't, they get picked up for absolutely nothing. The police will put them in handcuffs and send them on. And it's like when it comes to their probation, if you're being picked up over and over and over again and you're going before the judge over and over and over again, you're going to have to go and sit those days. And most times they're not getting new charges, but the fact that they're being picked up goes back to the original charge.
So it kind of blows their probation.
It blows their probation.
But let me ask you this. Why would the police be doing this if they didn't feel there was some reason to do it?
In my opinion, I don't think that they have a lot going on here in Bloomington. I think that the police are bored. I don't believe that their leadership is A1. The chief brought the sergeant over to the house, and I tried to explain to the chief the issues that we were having with the sergeant. The sergeant would not let me speak. He proceeded to say that we all got stories that we could tell. I said, well, you're telling yours. You need to let me tell mine. I had the president of the NAACP come out to the house. I was working with people who could make a difference to bring light to the police department.
Have you ever filed a formal complaint to the police department, and what has happened as a result of that?
I did file a complaint with the police department, and there was no result.
You want to try to work out something so that your sons don't go to prison or on these new charges and also the old spray painting charge. You've talked about restorative justice. What are you hoping will happen?
When I was growing up, we weren't catching cases for throwing rocks or spray painting. We would have to go and do community service. My mom, for one, whooped us. We got whoopings. And so I believe he don't need to have a felony charge on his record. He can go and clean up his mess. If the lady at the church wants Charles to do something for her, I will make sure Charles does that for her. But to have a 10-year-old thinking like, okay, what am I supposed to do now? I know that with a felony, when I grow up, I'm not going to be able to get a job. I'm not going to be able to get a house. I may not be able to go to college. I want to play basketball. He's 10 years old, but he's not a slow 10-year-old. He knows that having a felony is not a good thing to have, and it just takes hope away.
What effect on your family life has all this chaos and turmoil had?
We want to stay out the way. We don't want to be in the way with the police. We are afraid. We know that last year when we were trying to fight with the police, we lost everything. I lost my house. I lost my car. I lost every item of possession that I had.
Why was that?
Because of the raid. Everything in my house was set outside. Everything that we owned was set outside by the landlord.
So you had to move?
I didn't have to move. I was put out. And when I got out of jail, I got out of jail with the clothes on my back. And we are petrified of something like that happening again, because we know that regardless to how right we try to be, at the end of the day, the police will have their say.
People listening to this may take away that the police are right to be watching your sons because they're, you know, they've gotten into some trouble. They've gotten into mischief.
I would like to say that kids are kids, and yeah, I mean, people do a lot of stuff, and I want to feel safe. I feel like I want to feel safe. Police are here supposedly to make us feel safe. I would just want them to do their jobs. What Bloomington police tend to do is harass. And by all means, if you see some kids doing something wrong, go for it.
What I'm hearing from you is you don't feel like the police are there for you. That's the sense I'm getting.
It's not that I dislike the police. I mean, I have had conversations with some officers that go very well. It's not the entire police department.
What do you want to see happen? How can this situation be remedied?
Training, for one, and consistency. That they need to know that some things just aren't acceptable, and it needs to be consistent around the board. I don't think that...
What is not acceptable?
The harassment. I mean, you're driving down the street and you see someone you know that you don't have a good relationship with, you don't need to make it your duty to stop and talk to them. If you know that this conversation is going to go to the left, keep driving. This person's walking down the street. You know that person. You stop them just because you know them. You know that they may have gang ties, or you know that they may have gotten in trouble, or they may be on probation. So you stop them and harass them. Leave them alone. You can't walk to the store in this town. My son's walked to the store and gotten stopped for walking to the store. It's like he can't leave his house and go to the store because he's known by the police. That's not okay to me.
We've been talking with Antoinetta Simmons. She's a member of the community here, talking about policing in her neighborhood on the West Side. Thank you so much, Mrs. Simmons.
You're very welcome.
Antoinetta Simmons, the mother of a 10-year-old who was pictured being handcuffed by Bloomington police in a photograph that generated widespread comment on social media. Police Chief Brendan Hefner told GLT that while he empathizes with the 10-year-old and his teenage brother who was arrested at the same time, the family does have a history with law enforcement. He declined further comment because the charges involve juveniles. Louis Gosland is a leader of Black Lives Matter in Bloomington Normal. He's white. He says he became involved in the group because of rising mistrust between members of the community and the police. He tells GLT's Judy Valenti that he personally has witnessed a series of interactions between African-American teens and the police.
When I moved to the West Side, within a month of being there, I had 3 encounters with Bloomington Police Department who were pursuing people who were not engaged in any criminal activity. In fact, I was involved in all 3 of those incidents. The thing that tipped things off was walking by Friendship Park and seeing a group of kids. They were hanging out. There's not a whole lot to do on the West Side, and so kids get together and kind of just hang out around Friendship Park. This group of kids were approached by 2 police officers on foot. These officers started to kind of bump chests with them and ask them for intel. And so I watched, and the kids kind of took issue with that. One of them in particular was like, "Hey, why you come around here messing with us all the time?" And the officer then escalated the situation. And at that point...
In what way would you say...
Once the kid said that, he then stepped forward and was now towering over this, you know, pretty small kid and just became very aggressive. So at that point, I stepped towards the kid and just said, "Hey, you know, these situations can get out of hand. Maybe just let this one go." At that point, the officers turned their attention towards me and started to question me about, "What are you doing in the area? What do you know? What have you seen?" And so it was the harassment of kids in the neighborhood that got us, you know, some of the neighbors together to start talking about what kind of treatment people on the West Side are receiving. And it took off. There were so many people affected by this that we started growing and growing. And the thing that we realized is that in this community, Black people are being targeted at disproportionate rates. You know, the first meeting that we had, you know, had 30 people. This was last October. Since then, we've built a base of over 300 active members, and everyone knows the situation.
Talking about Mrs. Simmons' story, people may hear that and say, well, police are right to watch her house if they believe that suspected gang members are there. They're right to keep an eye on her sons.
You know, I think that when a neighborhood has been put under a microscope, and you're looking for each and everything that you can possibly criminalize someone over, it's hard to find folks who don't have some kind of charge against them. Pedestrian stop data was recently released exposing the racial disparities in Bloomington's stop and frisk program. When Black people are 4 times more likely to be stopped than white people, you should question what's going on with our police practices. When the evidence shows that 8 times out of 10 that a Black person is stopped and frisked and there's no citation and nothing illegal going on, that seems like a really unfair situation.
And Mrs. Simmons talked about feeling pressure to plead guilty of that particular drug charge because she needed to get out of jail. She needed to take care of her family. Do you feel that people are pressured to plead guilty?
One of the things that comes up time and time again when we work with folks is that people do take plea deals, especially when kids are involved, because oftentimes if you're not able to access sufficient representation, if you don't see a way out, sometimes taking a plea deal is the only way to get out so that you can take care of your family. And so while people may look at a situation on paper and say, well, you know, look at this, they were found guilty of this, one thing that people don't consider is that there is a definite disadvantage if you're not able to access proper legal representation and fight back.
Obviously, if you listen to some of these stories, there's a tremendous amount of distrust and suspicion of the police. There has to be a way to solve this problem in this community.
Well, I think the first step forward is for our elected officials and our police chief to acknowledge that there is a problem. And I believe the solution is community policing, genuine community policing, not these pro-social events that amount to a superficial PR event by the police department. Community policing means rethinking and transforming the way that we develop our policing practices that includes the community. So, for instance, community review boards. When a grievance has been put against an officer, it shouldn't be the police who are policing themselves. We believe that a community oversight board should be put into place to where people feel safe filing a grievance, because we've heard many stories of retaliation. We think a community review board should be empowered to review the data that's already out there, as well as the stories that they hear from the community, and make policy recommendations to the council. And we also think that they should have a hand in putting forth disciplinary recommendations for officers that are found guilty of misconduct. We want to work with the police.
We've been talking with Lewis Gosland. He is an organizer with Black Lives Matter in Bloomington Normal. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for covering this issue.
I'm Judy Valente.
The hearing for the 10-year-old who was handcuffed and charged with disorderly conduct is scheduled for Wednesday. Black Lives Matter has started a Facebook campaign encouraging residents to write State's Attorney Jason Chambers to get him to drop both charges in favor of a restorative justice solution in which the child would agree to make restitution for his actions. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. At our website, find the individual stories and interviews you heard today. Thanks to Willis Kern and Judy Valente. Also thanks to Mercy Davison and Carl Alexander to talk about the community's new bike share program rolling out today. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Let us know by posting your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is WGLT Normal.